Welcome to the Gospel Rain podcast, part of the teaching ministry of Dr. Matt Brown and Dr. Micah Carter. We hope you will find gospel-centered answers to your questions about theology and the Christian life. And now, we welcome you to the Gospel Rain conversation.
It's great to be back with you on the Gospel Rain podcast. We're glad that you have joined us for another discussion today about some things I think that will help us as Bible students, a discussion of the Gospels as a whole. Now, Micah, there's a misunderstanding among some people who may not quite know the New Testament very well that the Gospels all tell the same story, that the Gospels are all the same. So when you read one, you've read the other one.
Right.
And so there's a misunderstanding about that we need to clarify and help us understand as Bible students that each of these Gospels are very significant. Some of the things are similar, and we'll talk maybe a little bit about that. Some of what you're going to read in Matthew may be similar to what you read in Luke or vice versa, and including some of these other ones, but they're not all the same. Now, we can use them all together to tell a story, but they don't all write for the same purpose, and right. They don't all exactly tell the same stuff, and they don't all repeat each other, and so we find that out the further we dive into the gospel. So Let's get into a discussion of the gospels as a whole. Help us understand a little bit about just sort of some summary statements about the gospels to begin with. Why were they written, and why are there four of them,
yeah.
I guess we should say.
Yeah, those are all the questions we really need to tackle when we talk about the Gospels, because we do have four, and they say a lot of similar stuff, but then they say a lot of different stuff.
Yeah.
And one of the apologetics angles of the Christian faith is that critics look at the four Gospels, and they try to find discrepancies and errors and contradictions. And so we need to understand kind of what's going on. Why we have a Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John if there's one story of Jesus. So we just finished up a discussion on the intertestamental period, and now we're in the Gospels. And what happens in these four perspectives is a massive story about the life and ministry and teachings of Jesus, his crucifixion, the resurrection, all of that is kind of unfolding in this massive story. So, you know, some of the Gospels, Matthew and John, for example, are written for a Jewish audience.
Right.
Mark and Luke were written for predominantly Gentile audiences. So even from the perspective of them sitting down to write the story of Jesus' life, they've got a kind of a particular group in mind that they're trying to explain this entryway into the gospel about Jesus, his life. So because we've got four Gospels, we have to realize that we've got four perspectives. Mm-hmm. And, I mean, it's anything you and I do today. For example, if you and I were to sit down, for example, and write a history of North Mississippi, okay, we'd say some similar stuff, we'd say some different stuff, but you would have a perspective and I would have a perspective.
That's
right. And we're trying to admit, I guess, that there's going to be selective material that's going to be included. Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John do the same thing. I was struck by something John says at the end of his gospel in John 21:25. He says this very interesting. He says, "There are also many other things that Jesus did, which if every one of them were written down," John says, "I suppose not even the world itself could contain the books that would be written."
Mm-hmm.
Isn't that amazing?
Wow.
And I mean, I think he admits, look, Jesus did a whole lot more than even the four of us have given to you. There's more that he taught. There's more that we could say. And if we sat down and wrote everything, man, the libraries of the world couldn't contain it. And so what has been written by Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John was written for an important reason. And that reason is so that people can be saved by the gospel. John says it this way in his gospel, John chapter 20. He says, "Jesus performed many other signs in the presence of his disciples that are not written in this book. But these have been written so that you may believe that Jesus is the Messiah." Everything we've been talking about in the
That's
Old
right.
Testament,
That's right.
what the intertestamental period is picking up, that Jesus is this Messiah, that he is the Son of God, and that by believing, you have life in his name. So Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, if for nothing else, are unified that what they're writing about Jesus is good news. It is evangelism at the core, that you've got this story of this Galilean Jew, you know, named Jesus of Nazareth, that what he did and what he taught and what he did, especially on the cross and resurrection, if you believe, you'll have eternal life.
Yeah.
And they're all united in that.
Well, it helps us understand that these Gospels are not just biography. Mm-hmm. They are biography in some sense. They're telling a story, and they're telling where Jesus was and geographically and what he was doing, what miracles he was performing. But they have an intention to what they're writing. It's not just to tell a story, but a story with an intent and a purpose, so that you may know who this Jesus is and so that you may believe in him, so that you would be saved.
That's right. Yeah, and I agree with you totally that it's not just a biography. Now, what you have is biographical sketches of Jesus from Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John for Jews, for Gentiles. And so what they include in their writings is very selective. They're writing it for a reason. But I would say as you kind of look at all that they're doing, you have kind of, I say it this way, a historical, theological, biographical narrative. Now, that's a mouthful.
Yeah.
Because you definitely have a lot of history. We talked about it in the intertestamental period. You got Romans named by name, Herod
that's
the Great.
Right.
You've got world history unfolding, even in the day of Jesus. But you have a lot of theological stuff, especially in the Gospel of John. John is maximal theology in what he's writing. And then you do have some biographical stuff about Jesus. I mean, you have little bits and pieces about Jesus' mother, Jesus' brothers and sisters, his relationship with the 12 disciples and then their own families and their own stories. So you have some biography going on there. But here's the thing. All of this funnels down into the significance of who Jesus is. Okay, so biographical only helps to serve who Jesus is. The theological stuff, who Jesus is. The historical stuff, who Jesus is in the context of his day and for all time. For the purpose that when we're confronted with this information, that it stirs up in our hearts belief that if I trust in who he is and what he did, then I'll be saved and I'll be a part of God's kingdom.
Yeah, and they're trying to write down some things that they can pass on. I mean, this is actually going to be preaching material for the early church. This is going to be the material for them to be able to say, let me tell you the story of Jesus. And they're going to Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John would have been writing these materials so that people could use them later on. They could they could carry on the story of Jesus so that it wouldn't simply just be an oral story. But there were some things written down, and they couldn't write everything down. That's what John said. There's just too much he did and said. Can't write it all down.
That's right.
But we chose things that he did say and things that he did do so that we can tell his story so that other people would believe.
You know, and it's important because we throw the word gospel around, and I think it's important to clarify that there is the gospel, which is an announcement of God's inbreaking kingdom through Jesus Christ, his life, death, and resurrection for us and for our salvation. Jesus, his finished work on the cross is the gospel. We preach the gospel. But there are gospels, capital G. And I would argue, and maybe this is just the editor in me, but when we talk about the gospel, it's a little g. When we talk about the gospels, that's a capital G because we're dealing with a particular type of literature, the gospel of Mark, the gospel of John. And so we're preaching. So the gospels, capital G, these letters, these books, they serve and advance the gospel itself. So by telling the story of Jesus' life, his teaching, his parables, his healing, all of that stuff, they are advancing the gospel through what they've written. So that's just maybe a point of clarification for our listeners. Now, you asked the question earlier, why four gospels?
Yeah.
Why four? And I don't want to muddy the water, but there are other gospels that have been written and unearthed in libraries like the Nag Hammadi Library, these Gnostic gospels, the Gospel of Peter, the Gospel of Mary, Gospel of Thomas, that served to be the foundation for the Da Vinci Code that Dan Brown wrote and that Tom Hanks acted in, Gospel of Thomas. So why these four? Why four gospels in this way? Well, I think it's a good point that we can't oversimplify, but we also just need to say, look, there's one gospel in four perspectives, right? There's one gospel in four perspectives. So why wouldn't just one gospel have sufficed, Matt? I mean, why not just one and done? Why four gospels? Then they just repeat the same information? Is it just redundancy? I mean, what's going on here? I think is an important thing. As I think about this, think about the personalities of these different perspectives. Mm-hmm. So you've got Matthew over here who's quoting the Old Testament more than the other writers do. You got Mark, which is short, punchy. He wants to get to the crucifixion as fast as possible. He doesn't develop narrative very much. It's just real choppy, real fast stuff. Then you got Luke, who's a physician. It's very polished. It's very, you know, precise and thematic in what he's doing in his gospel. Then you got John, that's like a philosophical, theological heavyweight. I mean, he's not interested in necessarily all of the biographical stories of Jesus that are setting up a point for. He comes in and he's doing big themes like I am. He's doing big stuff like the bread of life. He's doing huge, massive thematic stuff, theological, like the good shepherd. Mm-hmm. That the other guys don't. They don't do the what right. he does. Very, very, very different. So, I think of it this way: you take someone like Winston Churchill, for example. Should there be this just one definitive biography? I don't know. I suppose maybe that could help. But how much has been written about Churchill from different perspectives in terms of him, his life as a husband,
right.
or, you know, his cabinet, or World War II, or, you know, I mean, so many different elements that round out a perspective on who he was. I think we're served better by more content than less. What do you think?
Well, that's a good point. I hadn't thought about it that way, but that's a good way to look at it. Well, you got these different guys that are all in the story of Jesus. These different guys take different places in the story. I mean, you got Matthew, who actually was a disciple.
Yes,
who
that's right.
spent these 3 years with Jesus in yep. ministry yep. and got to see these things firsthand. Luke did Huge. Not.
That's right.
So Luke is going to not only write from a different perspective, he wasn't even there. I mean, yeah. he did not see these things by, you know, he became part of the story later in the book of Acts. We find out about him as a Gentile doctor, and there again, you have Matthew, who's a disciple, who's a Jew. Luke yeah. is a Gentile.
Right.
And so you're talking about perspective. These two guys have absolutely, totally different perspectives in the stories of Jesus, but it's incredible when they write, they both agree. They both agree that he is the Lord, he is the Messiah.
Right.
And then they talk about different parts of Jesus's life, particularly based on who they're writing to. Matthew's going to talk about the Jewishness of Jesus and how yep. he fills the Old Testament. Luke's going to talk about the humanity of Jesus and how he came for human being. So it's really interesting how their perspectives are different. And Mark and John are going to be totally different.
Totally. You know, and Mark, you know, church history tells us that Mark was a disciple of Peter. Mm-hmm. And I think you can get that from Peter's letter. He says, you
That's
know,
right.
Mark, my son in the faith and this kind of stuff. Which is interesting because if you take that data, just that Mark was, he had heard the stories from Peter, that whatever Mark can recall, he's gonna punch it out as quick as he can to get to the preaching of the cross.
That's right.
And so, you know, he doesn't have an eyewitness account, like you said. He hasn't done a whole lot of research. He's been hanging out with Peter, and Peter's been telling him about Jesus and all the stuff that Jesus did. So right. Mark gets in there, and he's like, boom, this is what I recall.
Yeah, one of the favorite words that Mark uses in his gospel is the word immediately.
Mm-hmm.
And
absolutely.
So it's used it over and over. He says, and immediately he went here, and immediately he did this. And it's like you said, he's trying to hurry up and get to the crucifixion and the resurrection and that kind of stuff.
That's
he's,
right.
he's getting through these stories, and his book is shorter than the rest of them. But really, really cool when you start putting
absolutely.
These personalities together and figuring out where they were and who they knew and when who they were with and how much time they spent with Jesus or how much time they didn't, and then you put it all together. These are really cool stories.
You get a rounded out perspective, you know. And you know, I've always said, look, if somebody says, well, there's errors in the Bible, okay, well, show me,
right?
And let's talk through that, because I think when you read these together, you see that they're talking about a lot of the same stuff. I would argue they do not contradict each other. You know, there are chronological differences at
That's
times.
Right.
There are repetitions, and you got to kind of figure out, well, what are the what? Like, for example, the feeding of the 5,000, the feeding of the 4,000. Mm-hmm. Same event, two different events.
Right.
But they present things a little bit differently. Now, I think what's interesting is there are differences too. So as you mentioned, you know, you've got perspectives where, like Matthew, Mark, and Luke start from the ground up because their genealogy is forward. or they start with Jesus' baptism forward. But John gets in, and he presents this whole thematic difference. He's not interested in genealogy. He's not interested in those kinds
of things. Yeah, he goes back to the before the foundations of the world to say that Jesus is God,
yeah.
And he was with the Father. And so he really begins, sort of just hammers right there in chapter 1, verse 1, with a really significant theological argument the divinity of Christ before time ever began.
And you know, he was late in his writing, John was. So you're talking about AD 80 or 90 when he probably wrote his gospel. So he would have certainly been familiar with Matthew, Mark, and Luke.
Oh, yeah, which would have been almost 30 years later.
That's right.
Right.
So he would have had the data. Obviously, John was with Jesus. He would have known him as well, like Matthew did. But he's at a vantage point at the end of his life as an apostle, writing to pass on this, that he's got more of Genesis in his mind's eye, I think, than anything else, or even beyond that, like you're saying.
Exactly.
But here, you know, New Testament scholars talk about the similarities in terms of this phrase called the synoptic gospel. Synoptic means to see together. So Matthew, Mark, and Luke see together really the story of Jesus more than John. John is not part of the synoptic gospel because he's doing so much different stuff. And so, you know, they share, for example, in common the wording of Jesus' saying, a lot of the orderliness of his ministry. Their own comments seem to fit together, and then definitely Old Testament stuff coming together. But, you know, they have a lot of different stuff too, and that raises what scholars call the synoptic problem. Well, if they have so much the same, then why do they have differences and difficulties?
Right.
You started leaning into this a little bit when you mentioned, all right, so Matthew's an eyewitness. Mark is second generation Christian, getting it from Peter. Luke talked to eyewitnesses and collaborated data and did all the stuff together. John was an eyewitness as well. So they're coming together not just with a lot of oral tradition. I mean, they're writing the accounts of Jesus' life.
That's right.
So they would have listened, and you know, Peter would have had his own recollections of Jesus, and Matthew would have had his own recollections, and John would have been processing that according to their own personalities and their own intentions for writing. But it boils all down to, Matt, I guess the issue is, do they have a common source? Okay, so this is what is the source that is spawning all of the Gospels, all four of them? Without trying to get too technical, for the majority of the history of the church, starting with Augustine, they all believe that Matthew was the first. And so Mark and Luke and John would have been drawing off of what Matthew wrote. Okay, within the last 100-plus years of scholarship, that has shifted to Mark being kind of the first written, the primary source. So Mark in priority, that Mark is such a short, succinct view that Matthew and Luke then are looking to this choppy gospel and they're kind of letting it blossom in their own perspective. And then you got a crazy hypothesis of this document called Q, the letter Q, you know, writing, there was a source of information that they all kind of drew from that we don't have, that nobody knows what it is, but there's enough common information in the Gospels that they must have had something similar.
Yeah.
Q. I don't like Q, man. I don't. That just bugs me.
It bugs me too, simply because of the reason we don't have it. And that's the thing that really bugs me. If there was a common source out there, I would be okay with that. I would be okay with the fact that people are using other things. But I really, the thing that stops me there is the fact that we don't have that.
Right.
Nobody's unearthed some kind of document like Q.
Yep.
Again, I don't have a problem with it if necessarily those who espouse the view, but that's the main reason I put the brakes on, is because we don't have evidence of that written down. It's not there. Now, some would say that Q is actually found in all these Gospels, that
right.
we do actually have it. It's just it's spread out within the Gospel.
Right.
But again, I don't, that's where I put the brakes on.
So I was influenced by a New Testament scholar by the name of Robert Stein. He was one of my New Testament professor at Southern Seminary. And he actually wrote a book called The Synoptic Gospels. And in there, he kind of goes through all these argumentations, but he lands on Mark in priority, that Mark was the first written, and Matthew and Luke and John all kind of drew from him.
Right.
And honestly, man, I kind of, you know, I'm influenced by him. I kind of lean that direction too. And you know, I understand all the other arguments for the others too, but just in my own study and stuff, that's kind of where I've landed. But what about you? How do you fall in this kind of discussion, and any thoughts on where, you know, Matthew or Mark or where do you land?
I lean, I guess, and I don't have to say this, because of my time spent studying and the influences on me too, mm-hmm. Academically, and the things that I've read and researched and written on, that kind of stuff, I lean heavily toward the marking priority myself, but I realize I'm really probably biased, and I realize too at the same time, I've not gone back to read a whole lot of the people who put their cards in the Matthew priority
right.
camp. So to be fair, I've not read a lot of what they have said and what they base it on. Although I've had some friends who have in their writings research that they hold to a Matthew priority.
Right.
But I don't know. I guess. I don't know. I think probably because I don't know. Logic in that sense would say Mark is the shortest one.
Yeah.
Mark seems to be the most, like you said, the most succinct, and it seems to me that may have been what the others were drawing from. Although they don't copy directly from him necessarily.
That's right.
But they seem to maybe use what Mark was talking about again from his
like
conversations with Peter.
Yeah. And there's good, detailed, complicated arguments for both sides. Ultimately, it doesn't matter, I don't think.
Yeah.
But I think when you're trying to push to the question of what's the source, well, probably the best answer is eyewitness testimony.
Yeah.
And, you know, you got to be comfortable with an oral, kind of the passing on of oral tradition. Which for you and me, I can't even remember what I had for breakfast yesterday, but that
good point.
That's me. But yeah. You go back into a culture that was so dependent upon oral tradition,
yeah.
And they remember details. They remember everything.
This is true.
And it's you know, I've got much more confidence in oral tradition as in its development of the New Testament stuff than I, you know, a lot of people question that, like, because we can't remember, and we're in such an information saturated culture now that we got stuff shooting at us all the time.
Right.
But for them, I mean, this is what they repeated. This is what they told one another, preached, talked. Yeah. You know, so.
And with our technology, you don't have to remember anything.
Exactly.
I mean, how many phone numbers do I know? I mean, none. I mean,
I
know mine. That's about it.
Nope.
And so we don't have to memorize anything. But then in this oral culture, they did. They memorized. They learned right. these things, and it became part of their being. You know, it became part of what they talked about, what they shared, because they were passing these things down. Our culture is just not quite the same anymore, right? At least right now. So there are going to be some differences there. So anyway.
Well, and I think it's important, you know, that we clarify when it comes to the four Gospels that they're giving us a portrait of Jesus' life and its significance to lead Jews and Gentiles to saving faith in Jesus. And Matthew had a reason for writing. Luke had a reason for writing. John had a reason for writing. And it's not contradictory to each other's purposes.
Right.
It's just different. And they wanted to write about different things. You know, it shouldn't bother us, I guess is what I'm saying. It shouldn't bother us that John doesn't talk about the Sermon on the Mount like the others do. It shouldn't bother us that Matthew, Mark, and Luke and John don't say anything about Nicodemus and the Samaritan woman like John. John spends a significant amount of time
That's right.
with Jesus talking
That's
to these
right.
two characters. And so they had a reason. They had purposes, and I'm, for my part, I'm comfortable with that, and it actually adds to my understanding.
And where John's not interested in the reason why he's writing. John's not interested in telling all the miracles. Hmm. I mean, he really only gives seven of them, and where everybody
right.
else is talking about the healing of the blind man, the lame man, and the deaf man, and the all these other kinds of stories. John's not interested. Not that he's not interested at all, but in what he's writing, he doesn't really do all that.
Right.
John says, I've got seven in particular that I want to use, that I want to talk about, these seven signs or miracles that Jesus did, turning water into wine, some of these other things. Those are specific ones that I want to talk about because he has a theological purpose behind sharing those.
That's right.
So his reason for writing is just different than some of these other guys. So it's going to be that way with all these different gospels. They're using different things from Jesus' life and his teaching. And miracles to tell a story, and let me just say too that a lot of work for a lot of years has gone into this discussion, mm-hmm. because there have been a number of people who have created and published what we call harmonies of the Gospels, where people have taken great pains to put together these four Gospels and string them together in one story so that you can read it from the beginning to the end chronologically.
Yeah.
And they don't all agree on their harmony.
That's
because
right.
they might
right.
think, well, this goes before this, and the other guy may disagree. But for the most part, these guys that have done a lot of work on the harmonies of the gospel have really helped us to be able to weave these four gospels together into one singular story chronologically from beginning to end. And there are some out there, and people can get a hold of those, and those actually do help us with Bible study to sort of put these four gospels together. But that can help us. That's just a tool that's out there and a resource that can help us put these together.
You know, if you were going to start a gospel and to write, where would you start? Would you start with the humanity of Jesus? Would you start with the deity and eternality? Because John starts, you know, in the beginning was the Word.
Right.
I mean, he's going way back. But then you got Matthew. He's talking about Abraham. So you get this humanity, even though the incarnation is in full view in the other Gospels. I don't know, man. What do you think? I mean, I'm kind of predisposed to, like, I want to go all the way back.
Well, I think that's the theologian in us, like John. You want to go all the way back. But like Mark says, I'm not doing any of that. I'm starting at a baptism.
Yep.
I'm getting right. I'm for the purpose of my writing, I'm not worried about his mom and daddy. I'm not worried about his family tree. I'm not worried about any of that. I'm starting right at the baptism. I'm getting started. Let's start right there at the beginning of his ministry, because that's what's going to count for what I'm going to write. You know, so, I mean, they have different purposes for what they're trying to do and what they're trying to accomplish and who they're writing to, but that's sort of what Mark does. He just sort of jumps in the middle of the story, forget his childhood, forget any of that. He just assumes that, right?
That's right.
His writing assumes all that is true.
I love Mark. He's like, verse 1, the beginning of the gospel of Jesus Christ, the Son of God. And he starts talking about his baptism. He does like, look,
let's
I ain't got time
in.
To catch y'all up. Just understand, Jesus Christ, Son of God, this is his gospel. Here
That's
we
right.
go.
And I think, in large part, I think that may be evidence too, and this is one evidence maybe against Mark and priority, is that Mark may have known already that Matthew had already done that.
Yeah, provided that content.
Or that Luke had already done that. And so there was no reason for him to redo. Yeah. And that's one argument against Mark and priorities, the fact that he just jumps in right there assuming that all of that had already been taken care of by other people. So, but anyway, I don't know. I mean, you just think, where would you start? I don't know. I'm like you. I want to go back to the very beginning or before time. And John does that, but he does it so eloquently because he begins there. But then he doesn't talk about the family tree. It's not like he goes from Genesis and then goes all the way through the genealogies and everything. He so carefully begins way back before the beginning of time and then so quickly moves into his ministry.
It's
really eloquent how he does that.
Yeah. Yeah,
but anyway, I don't know. It's really an interesting discussion to talk about how these guys did this.
And I know we got to draw us to a close, but there was a thought that kind of crossed my mind when it comes to hermeneutics, and we talk about Bible interpretation. Is that for critics of the Bible, their hermeneutic, and I borrow this from feminist theologians, they have a hermeneutic of suspicion when it comes to the Bible. They're suspicious. There's got to be errors. They contradict each other. And they approach the text looking for problems. But for you and I who believe that the Bible is the inspired Word of God, it's infallible, it's inerrant, we have a hermeneutic of submission to the text. Mm. I'm not coming to the Gospels trying to get a gotcha moment, like, oh, y'all messed it up. I'm coming to the Gospels for the very reason that John outlined them, that this is a story of Jesus, that if you believe in who he is, you'll have eternal life. And and maybe it's a naive part for me as a follower of Jesus, but man, I'm submissive to the text.
Yeah.
God revealed himself to us.
Yeah.
And it's enough for me.
Yeah. And I think responsible scholarship, causes us to read critically, mm-hmm. but not be suspicious, as you said. In other words, good scholarship would cause us to say, okay, I'm going to take all these things, and I'm going to be responsible with them, and I want to make sure that I'm willing to say that Matthew disagrees with Mark. I want to be willing to say that if they do. Yeah. So I want to read it critically. I want to have an open eye to some things and make sure I'm reading responsibly. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, I don't want to come at it with suspicion as to believing that it's all a bunch of junk, and I just got to figure out what there may be a couple of parts that agree with each other.
Right.
We look at things differently, like you're saying. We want to read critically. We want to make sure that we're, which is lots of scholarship has, you know, taken place over years, which has taken us off into left field when it comes to the Gospels and all this kind of stuff. We do want to be responsible. We do want to read critically. We want to have critical thinking. But at the same time, we do have a presupposition when we read this.
That's right.
That it is absolutely inspired. It's inerrant. We read it that way.
Absolutely. And we don't want to fall into the trap that C.S. Lewis talked about, chronological snobbery.
Right.
You know, like, in other words, we should we hold the Bible to certain standards of scholarship and writing and literature and hold that over a Bible that was written 2,000 years ago? Mm-hmm. You understand what I'm saying?
Right.
In that, you know, because we have, for example, we have a verification process now because we're concerned about, you know, copying other people's ideas, passing them off on your own, you know, those kinds of things, and documentation, and, you know, how do we account for numbers? How precise should numbers be? And so we read critically because we understand that there are tensions in the text that if we're applying it with a grid of modern-day scholarship and
that's
verifiability,
right.
Well, then, okay, well, we've got to have that conversation. Appreciate you raising a point. Let's go into that. I think there's an answer for that. But, you know, and we recognize that as scholars.
That's
we do.
Right.
On the other hand, I think, man, you know, what were they writing for? Mm-hmm. They weren't writing for technical verifiability of certain things. It's there.
Mm-hmm.
But they're saying, I want to give you a picture of Jesus so you believe and have eternal
life.
That's right. And I think, you know, a lot of the critical scholars have lost ball in high weeds when it comes to that stuff.
Yeah.
Because they're looking for certain things. And you know, and if we're not careful, we can, like you say, over the history of New Testament scholarship, man, we can fall into, you know, things like Rudolf Bultmann and Adolf van Harnack. These guys looked at the Bible and they took out all the supernatural stuff because you know, we don't believe in a Bible because we shave with electric razors. That's what Bultmann said.
Right.
You know, I mean, what? That's what is that? What are you even talking about?
Exactly.
I drive an automobile that, you know, is like a metal missile, you know.
Right.
Combustion. I don't understand it.
Right.
What's going on in the engine? Just get me from point A to point B. But that doesn't prohibit me believing that Jesus raises the dead.
Exactly.
You know, but for him it did. And I think some scholarship can go that way. That's not you and me. We understand it.
Yeah.
Scholarship is a servant to the text.
That's right.
Not vice versa.
Well, and there's been all kinds of movements throughout even our modern contemporary history, the Jesus movement and other things. You have movements that rely heavily on their criticisms of the Gospels.
Right.
And ultimately, as we talk about just sort of the summary of the Gospel, that what you believe about the death, burial, and especially the resurrection of Jesus is going to dictate what you believe about the rest of the Bible, what you believe about Genesis, what you believe about Revelation. It's going to dictate that. So a lot of people that are, we would call, liberal in their theology, they hack away at the New Testament to remove the supernatural, to remove the miracles, to remove the resurrection, to remove any of those kind of things, so that what you have left is simply a view of a human guy, Jesus, by the name of Jesus, who taught good moral things, be nice to your neighbor and be kind and love each other, those kind of things. And when you take away the supernatural, that's about what you're left with. And the theological liberal has done that intentionally to remove the supernatural. And a large part of the liberal theology is to hack away at the Gospels.
Right.
That's where they will go, is spend time in the Gospels. And to take away some of those things so that you end up with not much left. You have a few sayings left.
Right.
You have a few teachings left that might be beneficial, but yep. that's about all you've got left.
So let me ask you this from a pastoral perspective, because I'm about to finish up teaching through all 66 books of the Bible. So I'm on Jude this Wednesday, and then Revelation, I'm done. It's taking me 3 years to do it on Wednesday night. But I would do like the prolegomena to books. So I would mm-hmm. talk about date and recipients mm-hmm. and author. And it kind of dawned upon me, and I've told my folks this almost, you know, every time we get into this, is I believe the author is Paul.
Right.
I believe the author is Peter.
Right.
I said, there are arguments that debate that. I said, I don't think they're worthwhile.
Right.
It's not that I'm unaware of them. I'm fully aware of them. And frankly, some of them are kind of compelling when you put all of the information together. But I step back at that and I say, you know, where is your source of authority finally going to be? Mm. You know, did a community of people committed to John's teaching put all this stuff together? I don't think so.
Right.
I think it's John who wrote it. Not John who wrote the letters, John who wrote Revelation. I don't bristle against that. From a pastoral perspective, I'm trying to engender for my folks, and I believe you are doing the same, a confidence in the text that at the same time, when you come to a book that, I mean, John didn't name himself in this, it's attributed to him, that is, does it help or serve our people to give them all this argumentation about why he's not possibly the author? I don't know, man. I don't think so.
That's a great question, and I think context is the key. I really do. What I mean by that is, you have a PhD, mm-hmm. all right? We both have a doctorate where we can sit down, and over a period of time, we can crank out a 40-page paper. Mm-hmm. We can do the research. We know how to write, even if it's on one part of prolegomena issues. Right. It may just be the authorship of a book. Mm-hmm. I can crank that out.
Oh, yeah.
I can take some books. I can do some research. And that may be necessary academically in a paper like that. Mm-hmm. But I don't feel the need to do that with my folks who may not follow my argument
and
may not understand what in the world I'm talking about.
Yep.
Because they sit in the pew and it says, Paul, an apostle of Jesus Christ.
Yeah, that's it.
And they're exactly going, right. It right there says Paul wrote it. Why would I even question that?
Yep.
So I'm with you. I do want to let my people know once in a while. I'll tell them, mm-hmm. not everybody agrees that Paul wrote this. Mm-hmm. But I agree that Paul did write this.
Yeah.
Now, I have reasons for that.
That's
I have
right.
reasons for my belief in that, and I've put some time in, and I've studied that. But I'm confidently saying to you, I believe Paul wrote that.
That's right.
And I think that at least for that, and from the pulpit to the pew, I think that's sufficient. Now, if I'm going to teach a different class, or if I'm going to get into some of those issues intentionally,
right.
then that's okay, as long as people understand I'm not questioning
yeah.
whether Paul wrote that or not, but I do want to show you the different sides of the argument.
Yeah, and the reason why I raise that is because these Gospels have been attributed to Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John.
That's right.
Okay. You get a lot of internal evidence that supports that. You got a lot mm-hmm. of external evidence that supports that. But at the end of the day, I'm not sitting around questioning, you know,
that's right.
Matthew, Mark, Luke, or John.
That's right.
It's settled for me. It's settled primarily because of the internal evidence, but also the history of the church.
That's right.
I told folks the other night when I was teaching 1st, 2nd, 3rd John that, you know, John had a disciple by the name of Polycarp. I mean, Polycarp attributed this stuff to John.
That's right.
You know, and I'm thinking, Polycarp spent time with John. I mean, he was with him. He talked to him, you know what I'm saying? And then Polycarp passes it on, and by the time you get to Ignatius and Irenaeus and Tertullian and all these guys, Origen, that had been passed down, but they spent time with Polycarp.
That's
Polycarp.
Right.
And Polycarp told me that John wrote, you know what I'm saying? So you keep pushing back. We have written documents that talk right. about what these guys
did. You know, what I think is interesting is that Polycarp gave his life as a martyr believing what John had said.
100%.
And 100%. What John wrote.
Yep.
Which is crazy when you start looking further down the line after these gospel writers and the guys who followed them as their disciples, many of them gave their own lives for what that person said and what that person wrote down. Polycarp wasn't with Jesus, but he believed John was.
Yeah.
And everything that John said, Polycarp believed as a disciple and was willing to give his life for it.
That's right.
I've read a lot of books. I wouldn't be willing to give my life for any of these other authors that I don't know. And I might believe in what they know, but I don't I might believe in what they've written. I don't know that I'm going to give my life for them. Right. And these guys were willing to give up their life for the sake of the fact that, what John told him was absolutely true.
Yeah.
And it goes on down the line. I mean, many other guys were willing to give their life for that. So I'm with you. I mean, I look at these guys and I don't necessarily question their authorship. I can get into some of these things academically. But when I'm preaching and I'm teaching with my folks, those kind of things, it's understood, and they know this. My folks know this. I believe.
That's right.
I believe they wrote it. I believe what they said is absolutely true.
Yeah.
And that they don't disagree with each other.
Yeah.
So when we start talking about the Gospels, there's a lot here that we haven't said.
Mm-hmm.
But when you start getting into a discussion of the Gospel, just know that all four of these men wrote a story of Jesus, a story from their own perspective to a specific audience. And they knew that,
mm-hmm.
and they were okay with that, and they missed a lot of things. They didn't write down everything. Even John said, I couldn't write everything. They wrote the story of Jesus so that people would read it and so that people would believe that he was the Son of God.
Right.
And that's what we use the Gospels for even today. It's why we preach them. We preach the stories of Jesus, his miracles, his teachings, all of that to show that he was the Messiah. He's Lord,
mm-hmm.
and he deserves that place in our own hearts because of what they said is true. So, great study of the Gospel,
awesome.
Sort of a summary of the Gospels, I guess, and there's a lot more that we haven't said that we could cover a little bit later on. But let me just, let's wrap up the podcast. I need to do that as quickly as we can for the sake of time with a segment that we call Did You Know? And as we get a chance to sort of give a little bit of trivia, could be worthless. I have a feeling that when we get to this portion of the podcast, I have a sneaking suspicion that either some people really turn this part off and they quit here,
right?
Or this may be why some people actually listen, is because it's fun.
What
and
are these fools fixing?
It's exactly right. What are they going to come up with? And I already know what you've come up with, and so I'm going first.
Okay,
all right. I got two of them. Did you know? And I don't know, I'm assuming this is true because I got this off the internet, and everything
right,
on the internet is
true. Yeah.
So, but I found this out. Did you know that high heels were first intended for men?
Why?
Not women.
Why?
I don't know. It's like back in the 14th
Now, I will say this as a vertically challenged male. I can lean into this a little bit.
Well, if they were created for you, man. People like
well,
you,
didn't guys used women. To, back in the day, wear makeup and wigs and all kinds of other
man.
Stuff, too?
Yeah, the big powder wigs, all that kind of stuff. Yeah, man. Anyway. So, all right, second one.
Hmm.
I love nature stuff, love nature shows and all that kind of stuff. I watch this kind of stuff on Discovery Channel. Not all of it's true. But anyway, but I saw one the other day, and I was telling my brother-in-law about this the other day. I just thought it was absolutely incredible. In Antarctica, there are big sheets of ice floating out in the ocean, on the water. They've broken off, you know, big chunks of ice. And so anyway, a lot of the seals will climb up on these, and that's where they will rest. That's where they will actually have their babies and that kind of stuff. And as a matter of fact, I was on a cruise to Alaska one time and saw that. Saw these big sheets of ice. We were cruising right through that in Alaska, and there was a seal out on one of these big chunks of ice, actually just had birthed a baby.
And, this is not a glacier or a iceberg or anything.
Like big,
different.
Just sheets floating out in the, and so small sheets. So anyway, these killer whales in Antarctica, they will come looking for these seals. So they will come and poke their head up out of the water like a cork. They will bob up and down, and they will look, and they will find one of these sheets of ice with a seal on it. Then they go underwater. They call for all their other killer whale friends.
Mm.
They all gather up in a group as if they like if they had shoulders. They would be standing shoulder to shoulder or floating in the water shoulder to shoulder. And they would all in unison, they all will rush at this sheet of ice with a seal on it. They will come up, and just as they come up out of the water, they will go under the sheet of water in unison, creating a massive wave that will knock the seal off the sheet of ice so that they can eat it.
Wow.
And if they don't get it all, if they don't get the seal off that time, they circle back around, they line back up, and they go at it again. It's incredible to watch these killer whales in unison. They're talking to each other. It's like, here's how we do this, and they know exactly what to do. It's incredible.
I'm changing my spirit animal to an orca.
Killer whale. Spirit animal. I love it.
All right, man. That's awesome.
Give us a did you know.
Man, mine's disgusting. And then, I don't know why it's on my mind lately, but anyways, did you know that you could buy in probably most grocery stores, in the meat aisle, alongside your bologna and ham and turkey. This, I don't think it qualifies as meat, man, but it's there. It's called souse. Okay, S-O-U-S-E, souse. Some people call it hog head cheese. They call it all kinds of different stuff.
Head cheese.
Head cheese. Yeah. And here's why. That you can boil the head of a pig or the head of a cow. And when it boils down to this gelatinous stuff, and you grind up some feet and some knuckles and eyes and stuff, snouts, it comes out as this. I don't know how to describe it. It's souse. That's what it is.
So it's a block of,
and it's like pickled. It's like pickled up, but the remains.
But it's like, but you call it cheese though. So
cheese.
So it's like a block of.
So
something.
You can slice it up, put it on a sandwich, and eat it. I'm gonna be honest, man. I've never had it, but I've seen this. And I got to inspecting this stuff one time, and you see little pieces of the snout and little eyelashes and stuff. It's just gross, man.
That's nasty.
And
man.
I can't believe it. I can't get myself to try it, but did you know that there apparently is a market for souse?
Did not know that, man.
Yeah.
That's nasty. That's absolutely
liver horrible. Cheese, I can understand.
No,
but,
I can't
but,
understand that either.
I'd try that, but souse, man.
Not, okay.
And there's
so
a
there's
pork
a reason
souse,
why they call it head cheese.
Head cheese, because it's boiled down
head.
The head.
That's
yeah.
That's nasty.
And, you know, okay. And from Europe and other kind of things, apparently when you don't have a whole lot to eat and you're using all parts of the animal, and other countries do a lot of this stuff with different things.
Well, I get that, but
you know, but Americans are, you know, we ain't hurting for, you know. I mean, just give
just
me some
give
ham.
Just give me the bacon, buddy.
Yeah, I mean,
just bacon. That's all I need.
Give
me
the bacon.
I don't
man.
Want the head.
I don't know. Maybe we'll do a video cast sometime where you and I need some souse.
That's crazy, man. Matter of fact, I want to. Our listeners who are out there, if anybody has eaten this stuff,
I'd like to know.
I really would. I would like to know if you've eaten this stuff and what you thought about it. Is it good? Is it not good? Is it bony, hairy? Is it? I don't know. I'm just curious now that you got me. I'm gonna go look for it. I've never seen it before, but I'm gonna go look for
it
at the supermarket.
Yep, souse.
All right.
Undeniable.
Great. Whatever. Well, let me close the podcast. Thanks for listening to the Gospel Rain podcast. We hope you enjoy what we're doing here, and we pray you'll just stick with us and share us out there on social media. And we'll see you again next time on Gospel Rain podcast.
Thank you for joining us for the Gospel Rain podcast. We hope you've been encouraged today, and we pray the gospel will reign in your life this week. Make sure to follow us on Facebook and Twitter, or check out our website at gospelrain.com.